I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is March 22nd, 2015. Let the record reflect that it is 3:30 p.m. Senators present today, committee members, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Stedman, Senator Walikowski, and myself, Chair Senator Giesel. In the audience, by the way, welcome to former Senator Joe Pascman. Ann is our secretary today. Jessica is handling the audio, and Ike is our committee aide. Today we're going to continue confirmation hearings. Mr. Craig Richards will be up for Attorney General, and then we're also going to take up the confirmation for Mr. Hugh Short for the Board of Directors of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. So we'll get right to it and welcome Mr. Craig Richards to the table. Welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chairwoman.
Senator John Coghill is joining us right now. So we were in the middle of asking some questions. So, committee members, any questions for Mr. Richards? Great. Well, I will begin. I want to talk, Mr. Richards, about confidentiality agreements and kind of get your thoughts on it. In January of this year, there was a Journal of Commerce article talking about a new confidentiality policy related to AGDC, and I wondered if you could fill us in on what you're thinking there, that you made some comments in it that this would be a new policy, that you had some concerns about the confidentiality policy that had been in place or is in place right now. So if you could talk about that.
Certainly, Senator Giesel. So I don't remember the specifics of the article at this point, but of course you remember having the conversation with Mr. Bradner, who wrote it. The basic idea, talking specifically about AGDC with confidentiality, is that there's a number of ways to handle the review of confidential information by, in this particular context, I believe the board members were under discussion, but also within the agency itself. So if it's okay, I'll just take a minute and sort of talk about the conversations that were occurring at the time and are still occurring now. And it's, what approach do you take in terms of identifying legitimately confidential information that should be confidential and is appropriately confidential versus information available to an agency that doesn't need to be confidential and therefore public policy would suggest should be available to the public and their understanding. And as a baseline, I like to use DNR because it's something we're all familiar with. Mm-hmm. And if you look at DNR, they have a regulation that says, not a regulation, I'm sorry, a statute in the Alaska Lands Act 3805, and forgive me, the numbers just escape my mind. But it says essentially that information that resource developers, oil companies, mining companies, et cetera, provide DNR is public except for an enumerated class of information. And that enumerated class is cost estimates, geophysical data, financial data, business income information, geotechnical work, things that you might say have some proprietary value or might cause companies some commercial harm if they were to go into the public domain, some competitive harm. So that's what DNR does, is it classifies data based upon the statutory scheme to determine whether that kind of information should be treated as confidential or whether it's available as public. The conversations that I've had with Ken Vassar, Dan Fowsky, and Jerry Jude, as well as Frank Richards, I believe, have been, is it feasible for AGDC to go to a system like that rather than one that uses blanket confidentialities? And that has been the dialogue. And there are currently draft regulations that are sort of floating around that people are reviewing to accomplish that task. So the more specific question then that's just the general policy of AGDC. And what that would do is it would say, rather than having these broader blanket confidentiality agreements all the time, you've got more of a defined class of what's going to be treated as confidential. In terms of the board members, the question is, do they access confidential information via a confidentiality agreement, or do you use a system that looks more like the Open Meetings Act, where again you have defined classes of information that a board may review in executive session or to prepare for executive session that is defined as confidential? And that's a question that also I believe AGC is looking at and is considering bringing regulations to the board to review. And they were sent to me on Friday, the proposed draft, and I have to admit I did not do my weekend homework and look at them. So.
So I think it's Mr. Jude that is from your department that's assigned to AGDC. Is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay. All right. Thanks. Questions from committee members? Okay. I'll ask another one then. While they think. I don't know. So we are joined today by former Senator Joe Pascvan, who presided over this committee on February 6, 7, and 8 in 2012. You and Mr. Brenna testified on those 3 days about the evaluation case related to TAPS. And pardon me, I have to take a sidebar here. Senator Machicki and now Senator Stoltz have joined us, just for the record. So, Mr. Walker, your business partner, also joined you on the third day, I believe. I could be mistaken there, but...
Madam Chairman, that's not my recollection, but like you...
That Mr. Walker joined you? Okay.
I don't even think he was in Juneau, but...
Okay. All right. That's great. I appreciate that correction. But you, of course, were part of that very contentious lawsuit on the valuation of TAPS and working for the city of Valdez. So it seems like that would be pretty difficult now that you're on the other side of the table to defend the state in that kind of a case. So how would you manage those kinds of past private sector experiences and now be someone perhaps advocating on the other side of the issue?
Well, Senator, I think generally, as a lawyer, your training is to work for your client and to do what is in your client's best interest. And last time I was before this committee, you know, I was asked about my past representation, and in that case in particular, I think, and some others I'd worked on. And my response was that, you know, I was very proud of the work I did for the city of Valdez. I think it was a good outcome for my client. But if I had been hired by the other side, I would have worked as diligently and, you know, maybe with the same level of success, or maybe not, I don't know. But that's what a lawyer does. You represent your client. And certainly as the Attorney General, I will represent the state of Alaska wholeheartedly, and I won't be representing my former clients. I'll be representing the interests of the people of the state of Alaska and the representing the state's positions and defending the laws of the state of Alaska.
Thank you. So in that testimony, actually on February 8th, which I understand you certainly can't remember the details of that, but a lot of the subject matter that day dealt with the duty to produce concept. So could you talk to us a little bit about duty to produce, when something, your definition of when something would be economic, requiring that duty to produce?
Senator Giesel, through the chair, I'd be happy to. I actually don't remember the testimony from that day, but I'm familiar with the subject, so hopefully we'll be consistent. The duty to produce is a legal doctrine that developed in the early part of the 20th century in the American common law. And essentially the question that was before courts was, when you have an oil and gas company that has a lease granted to it by a landowner, and that oil and gas company and the landowner disagree about whether or not something should be developed. And the law basically had to wrestle with the fact of what duty of care, what standard of care does an oil and gas company owe a landowner, the lessor. And there were kind of three options that were the ones that were debated at the time. The first option was that an oil and gas company doesn't owe any duty of care other than the express terms of the contract, and he can behave in a self-interested manner. The other end of the spectrum was the idea that some jurisdictions wrestled with early, and actually some cases adopted, was that, hey, an oil and gas company is really a trustee for the landowner, and he owes a fiduciary duty of care to the landowner, just like a trustee managing financial assets for a beneficiary owes a fiduciary obligation. And the courts decided, ultimately over a number of decades, most jurisdictions adopted a middle ground position called the reasonably prudent operator standard. And the reasonably prudent operator standard is comparable to the cousin of the reasonable man in torts. And that is that an operator in an oil and gas company owes a level of care to the landowner that a reasonably prudent operator would develop. If a reasonably prudent operator would develop a leasehold, then an oil company must develop that leasehold. So that's how the duty of care got defined. And of course, there's a whole lot of case law, most of it's pretty consistent, but it's, you know, a little bit of a juggle, about when would a reasonably prudent operator undertake a project. And the standard that is most commonly accepted is if they have a reasonable expectation of profit. So if you're an oil company and there is a reasonable expectation of profit that developing any development project on a lease would exist, then you have a legal obligation to the landowner to undertake that development project.
Thank you. So who decides if there's a reasonable expectation of profit? Well, let's bring the scenario here to Alaska, not Texas, but here to Alaska. Who would make that decision?
The DO1 lease form provides that dispute occurs before the Superior Court of the state of Alaska, presumably in a jury trial, although I suspect that at least if the state were involved with big oil company litigation, people would probably want to go with the judge because it's sophisticated, but who knows. But usually they occur before juries.
Okay. Would you be involved in defending the state's position on that?
Well, this is a hypothetical. I don't think anyone's currently talking about bringing a duty to develop suit, but of course if they did, as the Attorney General, I would be representing whatever the state's interests. It's pretty unlikely that I, as the Attorney General, would be in the courtroom, but I understand as an Attorney General you can try cases.
So typically you would assign that to one of your assistant attorney generals, is that correct?
That's correct. There's a number of attorneys within the oil, gas, and mining section that represent the Department of Natural Resources almost professionally. So it would be typical that you would use one of those attorneys.
Okay. Thank you. Other questions? Senator Welikowski.
Thank you. Just on the issue of conflicts, can you talk a little bit about the rules of professional conduct and what they say on the issue of conflicts with government employees?
Senator Welikowski, the chair, I'm not sure exactly what rule you're talking about, but I will give you just a broad sweep of my understanding of the rules of professional conduct as they apply to attorneys. The couple of aspects. One is you do have a client as a government attorney. The client is usually your client agency, but ultimately, of course, is the people of the state of Alaska, is the way the rules of professional conduct work. So I guess, Senator, I'm going to need a little more clarification on your question because I'm not.
Well, just generally, and I'm not trying to okay. pin you down on specific rules, but can you just talk about generally what the rules are about you representing a client that you previously represented? Are there rules that are in place in the codes of professional conduct? Maybe you can explain what the codes of professional conduct are, and then how there are specific rules that don't allow people with conflicts to manage cases that they already worked on.
Right. So thank you, Senator Welikowski, through the chair, for the guidance. The rules of professional conduct for all lawyers is that you can't work on a substantially related matter that you previously represented a client on adverse to someone else if you then are working for that someone else. So if you are adverse to a party, you don't work with them if it's a substantially related matter under most scenarios. The only way that scenario does not apply is if effectively everyone involved, new client, old client, agree to waive a conflict of interest.
Yeah, and then just on the issue of your representation of Valdez and the state was involved, the state and the municipalities, my understanding is, had fairly similar positions. They were both defending the value of TAPS, and they came about with different values. And it turns out, according to the Supreme Court, the state actually undervalued the Trans-Alaska pipeline. Can you talk about the positions of the state and Valdez? Were you going directly in opposition to the state at that time?
Senator Welikowski, through the chair. So there were a number of complex issues, and you know the primary issue is whether or not you value TAPS on its cost of replacement, or whether you value it on an income approach based upon the tariff revenues that the pipeline collects. And on that position, the state and the municipalities were almost wholly aligned. And that was the big fundamental question. But then when you got into the question of, okay, if you're going to value this on what it would cost to rebuild it today, less depreciation, what is the formula to do that? And going into that formula is literally thousands and thousands and thousands of inputs. Some high level, some very small, because it requires engineering and design studies to do an estimate of, you know, cost estimate of what it would cost to rebuild the facility. And the state and the municipalities were mostly aligned on those things in terms of what goes into the cost estimate, although there were some disagreements on, for instance, what contingency factors should be included in the cost estimate. The state was at one number, the municipalities were at a number. The one area that I would say that really the municipalities disagreed with the state on was how you calculate depreciation in terms of the existing facility vis-a-vis the hypothetical replacement facility. And so I would say, it's a long way of saying that, you know, I would say we're 70% aligned, but there was one or two contentious issues where the state had a different approach.
Bella?
Your position, the municipality's position, well, ultimately the court decided, I think it was worth $10 billion, and the state had advocated for a valuation of seven, if I'm recalling correctly. And then can you just talk about how much more in property taxes the people of Alaska would have had to pay had the state's position prevailed, or would have lost?
Yeah, Senator Lukowski through the chair. Yeah, I do caveat what they would have to pay is different than what the state would not have collected, because it's not necessarily clear that the lost revenue would have been captured at a local level, because half of the assessment goes to the unorganized borough. So the total amount of property taxes collected is 20 mils under AS 4356-010. That's 2% of the value of the property. So roughly, for every $1 billion in assessment, there's $1 million in taxes. I'm sorry, $20 million in taxes. So if you have a $1 billion assessment versus a $10 billion assessment, it's 2% of that delta is the total amount of revenues. And of those revenues, and I'm sitting here thinking it's $200 million, but I think that's right, 2% of $10 billion is $200 million. So of that basically $200 million that is the difference in the parties' litigation position between the municipalities and the TAPS owners, of that half goes to the state and half goes to the municipalities, roughly, within a couple percent.
Follow-up?
Thank you. And on the issue of conflict of interest, we've had some fine attorney generals in the past. Attorney General Burns, for instance, from Fairbanks, Attorney General Garrity, had multiple clients. Can you talk a little bit about how they dealt with the issue of conflicts and representing their clients, of which one was Golden Valley Electric, which is often before this committee, in fact?
Senator Wilkowski through the chair. So it's my understanding that they handled their conflicts in the same manner that I did. It's been a month or two since I've read their delegations, but effectively what they did is they identified within the Department of Law, I presume working through the ethics attorney, who their former clients were that had matters that were adverse to the state, and they delegated their authority over those cases to someone else within the Department of Law. I think I testified in a different committee that I delegated my authority to Martin Schultz, who's the section head of oil and gas and mining, because at the time that I came into office, Jim Cantor, who's the deputy director of the civil division, who in the past has been delegated authority, was out on long-term sick leave. So those delegations are with Martin rather than Jim, just as sort of a matter of where we are historically. And really that's the only difference that I'm aware of between how the delegations were handled.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski?
Thank you. On the issue of duty to produce, the position that you put forward on the duty to produce, is that that is, if a company takes out a lease on a property, that they have an obligation to produce it when they can make a reasonable profit or reasonable economics make it reasonably profitable. Is that what you'd call black letter law, pretty well understood law, or is that sort of some minority opinion, or are there many cases like that from around the country?
Senator Wilkowski through the chair, that proposition is definitely black letter law. It's the law in every single oil and gas taxing jurisdiction that I'm aware of. Now, the implementation of the law has some jurisdictional uniqueness to it in different ways that different jurisdictions have handled it. But the notion that a duty of care is owed by the oil and gas lessee to the landowner to develop if there's an expectation of profit is universal to my knowledge.
Further questions? Yes, Senator Michiki.
I have a question on that point. What would be the definition of reasonable profit?
Senator Kitchie, this is one of those where we're getting into each state's probably got a slightly different take, but my understanding of having read the literature, I mean, I've never handled one of these cases, but my understanding of reading the literature is as if it's a net present value positive project. If a producer can undertake drilling a well, you know, these cases often come up in the particular context of you have one or two wells on a ranch in Texas, and the landowner says, hey, I think a third well would pay. So, you know, the landowner goes out and he does some geology and hires a geologist and hires an economist, and he takes it to the oil company and says, hey, you'll make money if you drill this other well. And for whatever reason the oil company doesn't want to do that, then the landowner sues the oil company to get a court order that they have to drill the well and pay them for the lost royalty for the amount of time in which they refuse to drill the well. So I think I may have just gotten a little far afield there. I didn't directly answer your question.
No, that's okay. Yeah, I have a couple other questions, Madam Chair, if you don't mind. And I don't, Mr. Richards, I don't mean for this to sound even remotely confrontational, because it's not. I just have a couple questions I want to clarify. One of it went along with the, so on the valuation, you may have been on the same side of the state. There's a case where you were not on the same kind of side of the state, and it's just an attorney thing. You talked about the relationship with the client. The line of questioning here is going to be with the North Slope Borough and the City of Valdez exceeding the tax cap. And just for the committee's reference, I have a couple letters here, but a letter from the Tax Division to the State Assessor dated August 24, 2012, the North Slope Borough may owe about $49.7 million, the City of Valdez may owe about $56.7 million. It's total over $100 million that, you know, today, that $100 million means a little bit more than it did a couple years ago. It's a lot of money. And you were on the side of the City of Valdez, so you were in opposition, best way term I can use, I guess, from the state standing on exceeding that tax cap. So now are you going to be righter now, or were you righter then?
Senator Mikici, I am, as I said, that particular case was specifically delegated, so I'm not handling it. So it's kind of a were you lying then or lying now sort of question. I can't really answer it. I mean, the answer is that I'll defend my client's position. At the time, my client's position was that the money wasn't owed. Currently, my authority is delegated to Martin Schultz, so I'm not handling the case.
Yeah, Madam Chair. So that's, you know, for a non-attorney, that's a tough, it's a tough thing for me to digest, if you will. Are you committed to collecting the money now that you're representing the state? If the finding ends up remaining consistent that the entities owe $106 million?
Senator Mikici, through the chair, of course. If the courts make a ruling, of course I'll follow it.
Okay. And then one last thing, I'd like to hear that you recognize, well, I actually have two things. The first is, there are places you may have to recuse yourself in this situation, but how do we as Alaskans hold the confirmed Attorney General accountable in these situations where you have to pass off the decision to someone that perhaps doesn't have a conflict like Assistant Attorney General Schultz?
Well, I'm not sure that Mr. Schultz having that delegated authority is really different than if it was the case that there was no delegations because there was no conflict. I mean, at the end of the day, the Attorney General's office has its level of independence from the governor's office in this body to make decisions based on what's behalf of the state of Alaska. And it's certainly my expectation that any attorney handling any case with the Department of Law will be making those decisions accordingly.
Yeah, and I hope you can understand why that's hard for a non-attorney to sort of understand how that relationship can switch to a 180, you know. But so this is a different situation, and you talk about independence. Governor Walker, with him being your mentor, so to speak, it's difficult. So we know he had very little risk that your opinions are going to be he has a lower level of risk that your opinions are not going to match his than the typical governor AG appointment. I hope you can agree with that. But what I've heard from some, and I'm just relaying some thoughts I've heard, is with your Port Authority work, you all being so aligned, you and Mr. Whitaker and Governor Walker, it would be very difficult for Alaskans to get an independent view of those situations, just simply because of the 12 years of history. I haven't heard, I'd like to hear you recognize the perception of a conflict and help explain why we can expect independence from your office as opposed to the executive office.
Senator McKitchie, through the chair. So last time Senator Coghill asked me some questions kind of on the subject, and I struggled with calling it a conflict, because to me a conflict has a specific meaning, right? It's a legal concept or an ethical concept. And in the context of my relationship with the governor or my relationship with the Last Gasoline Port Authority, there is no legal or ethical conflict in terms of the way this is administered.
Trust me, I understand that issue.
Right. So what you're saying is the appearance of conflict.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like to talk about that. And it's not, the way I view it, it's not a conflict, it's a shared experience. We come from similar backgrounds. We have, you know, like some people might come from similar political parties, or some people might come from similar work backgrounds. We do have that shared experience. But I think in the context of the natural gas pipeline development, which is at least what the Alaska Gasoline Port Authority was involved, I mean, what I can do is I can point to you towards the broad background of the people in the administration within the Department of Law, within DNR, within the Department of Revenue, within the Alaska Gasoline Development Corporation, that have a broad level of background and experience. So although the governor and I and the chief of staff do have this background of working with the Alaska Gasoline Port Authority, you know, the commissioner and deputy commissioner of DNR have their background through the AGIA process. The commissioner of revenue, who's handling the negotiations on some of the tax stuff for AKLNG, has his background through the Stranded Gas Development Act process. The AGDC executive level folks, they have their background through ASAP. So I just feel personally that there is a broad breadth of experience and different points of view being brought to the specific issue of gas pipeline development, Senator. And I hope that answers your question.
It does. I have one last one.
Could I interject something first, Senator Michiki? I appreciate the phrase you used, shared experience, because as you know, we're all citizen legislators, right? So this doesn't necessarily pertain to you. In fact, it doesn't particularly. But, for example, Mr. Whitaker has opined that some legislators have conflict of interest and actually has rather forcefully vilified members of the legislative body, when in fact we have the same shared experience, perhaps, that you just described. Just a comment. Senator Michiki, further questions?
Yeah, I have one further one. And, it's not like you sort of defended Valdez on the tax cap. You're quite emphatic about the tax cap situation. How does one reconcile those feelings from being, you sort of answered it before, but again, it's difficult for me. I have a set of beliefs. I'm not an attorney. I understand it's different. But I have a set of beliefs, and I either sympathize with the person across the table or I oppose the person across the table, but I simply don't have the ability, especially where I have stronger feelings, as you did with the Valdez tax cap. How does one reconcile the switch? And I think I need something better. I think I need something stronger than who I'm representing at the time, because you put a lot of personal emotion into your defense of a position when you're an attorney. Can you help me with that reconciliation?
Well, Senator McKitchie, I can certainly try. Mm-hmm. I can certainly share my thoughts on it to the best I can articulate them. Representing Valdez in the tax cap case, just like representing all of my clients, I think you would actually be surprised how impersonal it was. I mean, you always get emotionally fired up, but at the end of the day, it was zealous advocacy to support my client.
And as I mentioned, I will apply the same level of zealous advocacy for my new client, who are the people of the state of Alaska. So for me, like I think most lawyers, that's not an awkward thing. I just gave you an example. There's several DAs that used to be public defenders. There are public defenders that used to be district attorneys. When you're prosecuting and when you're being a criminal defense attorney, you often become very, you know, emotional about your cases and about the constitutional rights and your relative roles, but that doesn't prevent people from sort of switching roles and taking on new hats in the later part of their professional careers and acting as lawyers and doing so and not missing a beat. So I guess from my perspective, I believe I have that impartiality, and I am very comfortable exercising it in all things and recognizing who my new client is and acting in its behalf. And there was a second thought I had, but it slipped my mind.
Follow up?
Not right now. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Just zealous representation means something as a lawyer. You actually have an obligation. I mean, can you explain that? Because I think that's important for people to understand. You actually have a legal obligation to, quote, zealously represent your client. That you can't just half-heartedly represent a client, or else you would actually be violating your bar rules. Can you just explain that?
Yeah, Senator Wilkowski, through the chair, that's correct. As a lawyer, you have an ethical obligation to zealously advocate for your client. And there are conflict rules in place to ensure that, you know, happens as much as it can. In government, the fact of the matter is that attorneys coming into the attorney general position or assistant attorney general positions often have worked against the state. The state is the largest economic driver, except for maybe the federal government. And government must function. And the way that the state has decided to handle these ethical situations is to use the delegation system that I've described today, and in consultation with the state ethics supervisor and in consultation with the bar association supervisor, I have done that. Let's leave it at that.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would it be okay if I got off of oil and tax or something?
Certainly.
Okay. Mr. Richards.
Thank you. Mr. Richards, last time you were here, I asked you about a couple of matters that have been before the Department of Law for quite a while, and you had, to say you had no familiarity with it would be an understatement. And what is your now, you have an enhanced familiarity with the two cases involving the United Cook Inlet Drifters litigation to close the personal use fisheries and to bring in federal management. And what is your position on those?
Senator Stoltz, thank you. I did have the opportunity to review the case summaries, not the briefing. Big difference between reading several page memo and, you know, actually digging into the briefs. But I am familiar with the USITA case and where we are. The state's position has and remains and will continue to remain that the state is in the best position to manage even the federal waters in all three instances where the federal government has basically allowed state management, including in Cook Inlet. We're currently in a position where the D.C. Circuit has ruled for the state management and not for the challengers, and it's before the Ninth Circuit, and a briefing schedule is currently being set up.
Well, I'll just leave a comment. I guess what that group can't get through litigation, maybe they'll get through appointments to the board process. So we'll just deal with it where we deal with it.
Thank you, Senator Stoltz. So I want to go back to oil and gas and ask you, under what conditions would you recommend a revocation of an oil or gas lease?
Senator Giesel, through the chair. So the revocations don't occur through, so you're talking about through the duty to develop process, because there's about 50 different ways that you could revoke an oil and gas lease. It would be part of litigation filed by the state of Alaska against an oil and gas lessee. It was part of the remedy requested in the trial, essentially. So the way different states handle the revocation of a lease in different manners for duty to develop. The model that I think is most common is Texas. And what Texas does traditionally is if you have a duty to develop suit or a duty to market or a duty to explore, all very similar kind of suits, just different stages of the development process, and you go through the litigation and the judge or the jury, the trier of fact, determines that the duty was breached, you generally have forfeiture as a conditional decree for development or marketing. So normally the way it works is if you were to go through the legal process and you get a ruling that oil company X should have drilled well Y and they didn't, then normally the order will say you have to drill LY within 1 year, and if you don't, your lease will be forfeit. So that is the traditional way that the duty to develop suits forfeiture occurs, is with the optional condition to comply.
So following up on that, so if DNR came to you and said, you know, we believe that this oil company actually would make a profit, and we want to revoke their lease, would you not have some kind of legal advice for them as to whether they would likely win that case or not? What would be your role?
Senator Geisel, through the chair, so my role as Attorney General would be to supervise the attorneys are handling the case, and certainly it would be to provide advice as to the merit of their case in terms of potential litigation. And like I said, these cases are expert heavy. They involve a lot of you'll involve geologists and a bunch of engineers on what it would cost to develop, and you know, probably some marketing guys on what the resource could be sold for, and you know, things like that. So if the case like that were to go forward, you'd assemble your team, and at the end of the day, a case really comes down to, I think more than anything, how strong your geology is.
So what level of NPV would you feel is a bar for determining that something would have been profitable?
Senator Geisel, through the chair, so the standard, if the net present value would be zero, greater than zero, right, would be an economic project. Mm-hmm. I doubt you'd really litigate one that's that tight. But that would theoretically be under the typical model. The question is, are they going to make more than $0 on a discounted basis? And of course, you know, one of the things you get into in all of these cases is what cost of capital should be used in your discount rate on the net present value. And again, there you apply the reasonably prudent operator standard, so you'll go to some kind of probably market basket of the discount rate for, you know, sort of the market of oil and gas companies operating in whatever region the case involves.
So would you be someone, in the past legislation has been offered that would establish a gas reserves tax. Are you someone that would advocate for that?
Senator Geisel, through the chair, I'm just not sure, as my role as Attorney General, it's really my job to advocate for anything. I will say that a gas reserves tax is, in my opinion, legal, because we've already had them in the past. But in terms of whether or not that's good policy, I think that would be somebody else.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Stedman, did you have a question?
Yeah.
Okay.
We had a few governors ago that took the initiative to task over Point Thompson. Not so much dissimilar than duty to produce. The leases had gone on for decades, and the feeling was that area needed to come to market. So if you were Attorney General back then, would you have supported Governor Murkowski's endeavor to push forward and get Point Thompson moving forward?
Senator Stedman, if I had been the Attorney General at the time, I certainly would have supported the Department of Natural Resources and my representation of that client agency. So I certainly would have provided them the legal advice they needed to move forward with the suit as they did.
And I think that's very positive. It looks like that's one of the big impetus in pushing our gas line forward, because it's a gas field with billions invested in it that needs to go to market. One of the concerns seem to be expressed here, and beaten around the bush a lot, is you've been a successful attorney for your clients. You just happen not to work for Exxon, BP, or Conoco. You're on the other side of the table. Tell us why the other side of the table shouldn't be worried about a successful attorney, and why they would not be. I'll just leave it at that. I got a follow-up question.
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I think that my background and experience in oil and gas litigation is a real positive. I really do. I have a lot of experience, excuse me, crick my throat. I have a lot of experience about oil and gas in the state of Alaska. I have a lot of experience about the oil and gas industry in the North Slope in particular. And in terms of a lawyer, I have a deep body of knowledge that will be useful, I believe, in being in the Attorney General and working with the oil, gas, and mining section and the cases that they have, both against the oil companies and with the oil companies. Because, you know, I'm sure everybody here knows that there are many cases that go all kinds of directions, you know, and the Quality Bank litigation, you generally have the taps owners suing each other, right? In the tariff litigation, you generally have the state and the independents suing the taps owners. In valuation cases, you got taps owners suing the municipalities with the state kind of on their side. So in this multifaceted litigation, in the environmental cases, the state's generally with the oil companies, you know, suing the federal government. So in all of these cases, you know, you have these different combinations, but that's just the nature of very complex, high economic, high dollar value development, is that you just end up with a lot of litigation. And I think my background will be very valuable to helping guide some of that litigation in the future.
Follow-up, did you say, Senator Sidman?
Well, I was just going to make more of a comment. I think, quite bluntly, if this candidate would have been working for the oil and gas industry, the line of questioning would be substantially different. And I personally, it doesn't bother me I don't care what side of the issues a particular attorney represents. I want the attorney to work for us, or me, the people. That's the best we can get. And who wins? I'm not interested in hiring a loser. So in the event that we find candidates that can't move back and forth across the line, we can deal with it at the time. But I'm glad to see we got a successful attorney in front of us. And quite frankly, if he doesn't get the appointment, he's got a resume here, sends it to BP, Conoco, and Exxon, works a few years, we'd probably make a bronze statue of him and give him the job of the next governor. That's my opinion of the case.
Thank you, Senator Sidman. I believe you expressed that last time, the winning attorney. I guess for many of us, there is still, as Senator Michicki alluded to, that question of core values and at what point one's core values direct one's actions. And so that's a little difficult for some of us to reconcile. I think Senator Michicki had a question, and then Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, I actually resent the last beating around the bush comment, because my comments had nothing to do with oil companies. They had to do with tax valuation between the state and municipality. So, but I assume Senator Stedman wasn't talking about my line of questioning. So the question I have is about the Pentex sale and antitrust. I'm very curious about that. Now, had your antitrust finding not involved a potential purchase by a state agency, I would have had no questions. I always have my own antitrust issues. I want the best deal for the ratepayers of the state. It complicates things with the ADA acquisition of those facilities. So can you give me a little help on helping me to determine the value of how I separate those things. Again, had there been another buyer that was interested in those assets, I may have supported your call the whole way. I'm struggling with the call at this point, and I don't know what your ultimate ruling is going to be on the Pentex assets, but I'd like to hear your take on that situation.
Senator Michicki, through the chair. So I don't really believe that the Department of Law has taken a position in terms of antitrust grounds. The Department of Law has taken a position in terms of rate-making issues. So just a quick sketch of the time frame as I understand it. About a year ago, something like that, the litigation began before the RCA about whether or not the liquefaction plant should be rate regulated like the distribution stream upstream. The state took the position that it should, or we should at least look into the economics. Then just shortly before I came into office, F&G entered into a deal with Titan did, who is the subsidiary of F&G. Well, first, F&G removed Titan from the F&G umbrella and created it as a subsidiary, and then they moved to have it sold. They did this before the question was decided about whether or not the facility itself should be rate regulated and provide cost-based service. So the position of the Attorney General's office has been for some time that it should be cost-based service, and that, or at least that should be explored by the RCA, and that the sale should not go forward until that determination is made. So those decisions were all made before the F&G ADA acquisition was even contemplated, or at least that I was aware that it was contemplated. So that's where we are, that regardless of whether or not ADA does or doesn't acquire F&G, the question still needs to be decided about whether that plant should be rate regulated on a cost of service basis.
Follow up.
Thank you for that. I want the very best AG we can find. I want you to be a successful attorney. I'm thrilled about that. If you had been an oil company attorney that had been successful against the state regularly, I would be much more concerned. The difference that I have in this case is I was a small town mayor in Soldotna. I've got to admit, when Soldotna issues come up, it's difficult sometimes to not be somewhat parochial about my hometown. It's where I live, it's where my kids go to school when they're not here. It's tough. So how do you shake that sort of more parochial view, even though they used to be clients and you have a new client now, your hometown folks, how do you deal with that?
Senator McKissey, through the chair, I mean, you just... To me, the question of whether or not the LNG plant should be rate regulated is fairly academic, and I think it's one that needs to be answered. And in the law of rate making, it's something that occurs all the time. So to me, I don't feel any. It's so academic that I haven't even spoken to very many people about it, other than the attorney that's handling it within the Department of Law. In terms of the bigger picture, getting gas to Fairbanks, which is what we're really talking about, and I'm a Fairbanks kid, I certainly want to help all of the state government achieve that goal to the extent that that's what my clients want to do. So I hope we can collectively do that.
Okay.
Senator Stoltz was next.
Oh, I think I'll just pass.
All right. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Switching gears a little bit, as a principal in your law firm, you were responsible for meeting payroll to your entire staff. It's going to be a little different role as Attorney General because you've got a fixed client. How do you envision taking your private experience from your law firm and driving it down into the work ethic of the department to keep the crew motivated as if it was a private law firm that had to meet payroll with production?
Senator Stedman, through the chair, I wouldn't say I'm lucky. The state of Alaska is lucky in that the Department of Law is a pretty good organization. It's pretty well run. I would say that the one area that I think that my experience can be helpful is to help coordinate some of the litigation teams in some of the complex areas and sort of work with them to, maximize the state's chances of victory and efficient use of resources. In particular, having handled some very complex cases and having the resources to do it, I think there are just some small adjustments that could be made that would be helpful, like better use of paralegals as an example. The Department of Law tends not to use paralegals as much as private firms do. That's one area where I think we can achieve cost savings and provide better legal services. I also think that an advantage that you have in private practice is in smaller firms, the mentoring to the younger attorneys is a little more focused because you're working with the same people day to day. So I hope to encourage that activity. So those are the two that jump to mind, Senator.
So I want to bring us back to AKLNG for a moment. So about a year ago, and I don't mean this as an inquisition, but it's a piece that you wrote in January of 14, an op-ed piece, in which you said that Senate Bill 138 was an end run around the Constitution because in it we are taking production taxes in the form of actual molecules, so tax as gas, right? So You know, that was a pretty carefully crafted bill. You're saying that we were acting unconstitutionally. Can you explain what you meant by that and if you still hold that view?
Senator Geisel, through the chair, so I think the constitutional concerns I had and still have weren't related to taking taxes gas. It's the fiscal certainty piece. As everyone here is aware, Article 9, Section 1 of the state constitution says the state of Alaska cannot contract away its power to tax. And the concern I had then is that what the state was going to do was essentially a Murkowski-like contract that did just that. So my concerns are a little alleviated, and they're a little alleviated because I feel comfortable that if ultimately that is where we arrive, then we will have the opportunity under this administration to seek a constitutional amendment to achieve that objective. And also, being part of the, I eventually will be part of the negotiations, and I'll understand the deal, and I'll be able to see whether or not I feel the proposals do require a constitutional amendment.
Thank you. There's water right there. Nobody's drinking.
I'm always leery about whether it's the gas guys.
I totally understand, but I don't think we've poisoned anything. So, Senator Wadakowski.
Thank you. On the issue of the constitutionality, that's not just your position. That's a position that's been taken by legislative attorneys, by executive branch attorneys, by independent attorneys about the constitutionality of exactly what you said for the last decade at least. Is that correct?
Senator Wadakowski. There are a number of attorneys that have taken the position that at least the Stranded Gas Development Act contract as adopted would have been unconstitutional without an amendment.
So in House Judiciary, you cited a white paper by former AG Botello. I think it was related to, was it the Chinese Wall or something? So my question is, have you been collaborating with former Attorney General Botello? Is he a mentor? Will he be advising you going forward?
Senator Geisel, through the chair. So it wasn't a white paper. It was a 1995 Attorney General's opinion.
Okay.
And the fact that Mr. Botello was involved in helping set up the administration has nothing to do with that opinion. And it was brought to my attention by the ethics supervisor, not by Mr. Botello. And in terms of my relationship with General Botello, sorry, I should use his honorific, I didn't even meet him until a couple months ago. I have gotten to be friends, but he's left the administration, and I don't foresee any role he'll have in the Department of Law.
Thank you. So I want to switch now to mining, the subject of mining. So out in southwest Alaska, there's a pretty large mineral deposit, copper, gold, etc., called the Pebble Deposit. Right now, that company is challenging the EPA's preemptive ruling. If they are successful, would you be someone that would, and the state came to a position where we were actually suing the EPA to ask them to step down, do you feel that you would be able to defend the state in that viewpoint?
Senator Geisel, through the chair, I do. I don't think the 404C veto was legal, and I do believe it was an abuse of discretion. The state had previously filed a lawsuit to support the Pebble position, but that was essentially kicked out as untimely until the Pebble decisions were made. I believe the nature of the suit was that it violated the statehood compact. If in fact the course of events run that challenge could be brought again and it would be useful, i.e. Pebble hadn't won on other grounds, I wouldn't have any difficulty bringing the challenge.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Stoltz.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Get better at this. Madam Chair, General Richardson, Richards, excuse me, not Elliot, Craig. on the issue of mining, there's one proposed mining development which the Mental Health Trust has major, there's probably more than one, but one in South Central, the Chewitna Mine. The Department of Law, under, I believe then, Attorney General Charlie Cole, brokered the Mental Health Trust settlement and royalties and mining was and other getting value out of property was part of that very long fought delicate settlement. What on behalf of the beneficiaries who over many decades, fought that case, and that over a lot of attorneys, it was finally settled, and the state signed that that settlement agreement. What role do you think you have a responsibility on behalf of the Mental Health Trust beneficiaries, and for Alaskans watching, those are Alaskans with intellectual and developmental disabilities, those with autism, fetal alcohol spectrum, the myriad of others that we would view as of the most needy Alaskans. What do you believe that you have are compelled to have an advocacy role in helping the trust develop and litigate against other forces on a just Chewitna happens to be the one that's front and center, and it has a lot of potential for those beneficiaries, of which your department under Charlie Cole, who I think is almost has sainthood status in the Department of Law, of upholding that settlement that he brokered.
Senator Stoltz, through the chair, it is certainly my view that a primary job of the Attorney General and the Department of Law is to encourage legal resource development consistent with agency policy. And the Mental Health Trust takes their obligations very seriously, and they need to develop their resources to collect the funds to help Alaskans, and I'm certainly will be diligent in helping them do that.
Madam Chair,
yes, if I might.
Does that include proactivity? You have a lot of voices within your administration that have in other lives, and maybe they were able to spin on a dime and change their position just as you have. But do you see an enhanced responsibility for you to come to the aid of those beneficiaries and the folks that have the moral and legal responsibility to uphold the trust beneficiary relationship, which is a pretty, as you, I'm not a lawyer, but I do know that's a very high level of legal responsibility and moral commitment beyond just the bland general enhanced responsibility, even being proactive and taking on some of your friends in the administration.
Well, Senator Stoltz, I mean, the answer is I want to help the Mental Health Trust develop the resources and help the residents, but I am the attorney, so I'm absolutely going to help the Mental Health Trust folks do everything I can, and I certainly will support theirs, but I guess I'm not sure what you mean by being proactive outside of that capacity.
Madam Chair? Are you seeking guidance from the legislature so we can be helpful on behalf of the beneficiaries and give you some guidance and maybe buck up your position? Is that something that would help you?
Senator Stoltz.
Resolutions or budget language?
Senator Stoltz, it would be helpful. I've tried to reach out to everybody in this room, and I've tried to be open with dialogue and understanding what we can all do collectively to help the state. So, absolutely.
And Madam Chair, I don't mean editorialize, but this has been I have a real strong commitment toward helping our beneficiaries, and sometimes some of my colleagues and other advocates, their commitment ends when the viewshed begins, and it's really frustrating, and I believe that state agencies, including yours, have a proactive responsibility to help these entities be aggressive in litigating, being forceful, working with your Department of Natural Resources and your Division of Mining, and doing development that's responsible on behalf of the. I think it's a much higher responsibility, and I think a lot of administrations have been very lax on this, and it's an incredible opportunity. Not any one particular development, but it seems like the default position has always been, let's do it somewhere else, or let's look at another development. And we can't continue to do that in Alaska. If we're going to keep our moral and legal responsibility, and it's intertwined with land development, whether it's timber, whether it's mining, and I think this is a chance for you and your administration to be champions on behalf of some of our neediest Alaskans instead of some of the other special interests that Water's Edge is their viewshed. So thank you, Madam Chair, for that indulgence.
Sure. So today we heard from a former Attorney General, Dan Sullivan, who's now a U.S. Senator. And one of the topics he touched on was the EPA. and their significant overreach into Alaska. He mostly referred to the Clean Water Act, right, and waters of the U.S. But another aspect of that is the Clean Air Act, the 111D rulemaking that they are proposing, that we're still waiting to see what comes out. We've asked for a waiver on that because we have abundant resources. You know, we talk about our Constitution saying develop the resources for the maximum benefit of the people. So if they do not grant us a waiver, and those new rules are so egregious that our utility rates go up, of course, we would be looking to you, the Department of Law, the leader of the Department of Law, to push back on the feds. Now, the governor has expressed a reluctance to enter into lawsuits against the federal government. How does that constrain you, or do you act more independently?
Senator Geisel, through the chair, so to address the last question first, I mean, when you're the Attorney General, you always act in consultation with all of your agency clients. The litigation decisions are ultimately rested within your office. I think in this particular case, that we are actually already challenging them and have oral argument challenging the legality of the regulations, supporting a Michigan case coming up in the next couple of weeks. So we've already gone down that road, and certainly I have not changed the state's position at all and don't intend to.
Great. So in that more global question, mm-hmm. So you act independently of the governor. That is, his advice to you, enter this lawsuit or don't, would not affect you. You would make that decision independently.
Senator Geisel, through the chair, I mean, like I said, with consultation, you know, you always listen to all of the stakeholders, and certainly the governor is a large one. But at the end of the day, it is an independent office, and the decisions are made independently by the Attorney General in terms of the bringing, the handling, and the disposing of litigation.
Thank you. Further questions? Senator Coghill.
I'm glad to hear that. One of the things that the governor gets to be is kind of one of the biggest landlords in the United States. He also has to deal with BLM, Department of Parks, Forestry, and they wield almost the equal authority. So in many ways, we have the Statehood Compact to help us. We have ANILCA. We have the ANCSA law that are all part of how we define the rules. It looks to me like the federal government is at this point scofflaw. So I would encourage you. And the latest one is the National Park Service trying to stop Alaska predator control along the borders of their parks, where we've done traditional hunting, trapping, subsistence use, and that sort of thing. So is that something that's come to your attention, and how are you going to proceed on that?
Well, Senator Coghill, through the chair, certainly it's before the Department of Law. We filed extensive comments opposing the proposed regulations that are the change in policy. And it's not just that they're using predator control as a bit of a guise to backdoor larger management issues. And in the process, they're doing it through rules other than ANILCA, which removes their obligation to consult under ANILCA with the state before rules are published. Because obviously you can have a lot more impact on rules if you can get into the process and provide your comments before the initial versions are published. So we filed our comments. We've asked them to reconsider the regulations, and they'll make a decision. And at that point in time, we'll have to make a decision about whether or not there's legal grounds to challenge them.
Madam Chair, I think you hit it right on the nail. There are those tools that are used, and I would call them a ruse. Their guidance, they will call a management scheme guidance to get out of the rulemaking process. And so as you work through some of those issues, I know that we in the legislature have spoken many times by way of resolution. There are ways that we can support. But I was encouraged to hear you say you would zealously defend the state's position. This is one case where we need to be on our A game to defend the many incursions. The Waters of the United States, the Endangered Species Act, you know, a variety of different things. One of the things that we struggle and we like to argue amongst Alaskans is the whole Article 8 of our Constitution. There's a continual push to try to give users benefits rather than users benefits. And that's probably, since you're a civil lawyer, this will be reams and reams and reams of paperwork, whether it's at the Board of Game, Board of Fish, those places. But most of us who don't get involved in the minutiae of it try to keep with that ground that Alaskans should be treated equally. They should be good common use and good management schemes to get that. Have you thought through how you will work with Alaskans? Obviously, we have our Constitution as a guide, but it's been tested in a variety of different ways. Is that something that you've been aware of, alert to, practicing, or is this an area that that you have to work on yet?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, so it's an area that I'm becoming aware of, but I had not, other than an Alaskan that consumes information and is a hunter, mm-hmm. you know, followed at that level. It was not an area that I ever worked in legally, but I'm jumping in with both feet.
Yeah, thank you for doing that. And it's a contentious area in many ways, mostly between subsistence users, personal use. Certainly, that's one of the issues. But geography is a big deal in that. And how to keep from falling into giving anybody a special right to resources and still take care of people in good geographical areas is a tough question that's coming your way.
Thanks, Senator. And co-management with the federal lands, too. It's
right.
A lot of issues.
All right. We are going to have to get to public testimony here very shortly. Senator Costello.
Thank you. And through the chair, I appreciate the memo that you sent me following my question about the 111D rule in the Department of Law's budget overview, so I appreciate that. Currently in this committee, we're working out on a bill that has sort of a double negative issue on page 1, lines 10 through 12, and on another part of that bill, my question had been, with the state's involvement in pushing back on the 111D, which I appreciate, I think it's important, would it be ill-advised for the legislature to then apply for a waiver or an exemption for a law that we're, or a program that we're, that you're, the administration is saying the EPA doesn't have the authority to actually even send our way?
Senator Costello, through the chair, I'd have to look at the specifics in detail. I mean, I'm always a little concerned to say you can't do something and then ask you to do it. But that being said, oftentimes there are ways to preserve your right to make legal challenges to a program, but still do the necessary work that you need to do in the meantime. So I'd have to look at the specific issue to be able to give an exact answer.
Yeah, but one more question.
We'll follow up, Senator Costello.
So we've gone around the dance floor a little bit about, you know, are you a great attorney and are a good attorney, and well, you know, the assertions made that if you're a good attorney, then we want you on our side. You will have to delegate some of your authority, essentially, to others in state government. So how would you respond to Alaskans who say, there would, you know, if we approve you or, you know, have you as our AG, that we don't really get you as our AG because you've had to delegate some of your caseload off to others?
Senator Costello, as I said, almost every attorney general coming into the position has had to do the same thing. I think the difference between my delegations is the cases are a little more high profile than maybe some of the ones that other attorney generals have had. I would just say that those delegations relate to four specific cases, maybe five, but I think four, that are ongoing. They're cases that have been going on for a very, very long time. And the attorney that has the delegations are the same attorneys that have been handling them for a very, very long time. So I think in those limited areas, the state is in very good hands, and it's a relatively small part of the job. And I think that the experience I had from handling those cases and others more than outweighs the loss of value to the state and not having the attorney general in a couple of particular cases.
Thank you.
All right. I do want to open up public testimony. We have new electronic materials for knowing who's online wishing to testify, and there is no one online wishing to testify on this confirmation. Is there anyone here in the room that wishes to give public testimony on this confirmation? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. Any further questions from committee members? All right, seeing none, Mr. Richards, I just want to thank you for coming back to the committee. I know it is probably an unusual feeling to you to have the Resources Committee reviewing your confirmation, but you can see where Resource Development State. We have a lot of concerns, of course, about Department of Law, but I do want to respectfully acknowledge your very successful career as an attorney, and again, just thank you for coming. We are going to be signing transmittal documents of your confirmation. That is the fact that we've heard it. We're sending it to the joint session. So we'll be doing that at the end of the meeting. We do have another confirmation to hear right now. So, again, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you, Chair.
All right. The next confirmation hearing is for Mr. Hugh Short. And so I will invite him to the table. Welcome, Mr. Short. Thank you for your patience. As you can see, we're a pretty interested committee in our resource issues. So thanks for being here, and thank you for patiently waiting. If you would introduce yourself for the record, give us a brief overview of your qualifications, your experience.
Great. Thank you, Senator. Through the chair, thanks to the Senators here. I've prepared some comments that I'd like to read into the record.
And, great.
First off, my name's Hugh Short. My occupation is CEO and chairman for PT Capital. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity to address Senate Resources. I'm honored to be before you today to be considered to serve you, the governor and the state of Alaska, as a board member of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. The economic future of the state of Alaska is in a precarious situation with the dramatic drop in oil prices globally. I'm thankful to each of you and your leadership and the responsibility that you bear to lead us through this difficult economic situation towards a sustainable future. As a board member of AGDC, I would take my responsibilities seriously. My top six priorities would include the following. First, to produce competitively priced, reliable in-state gas. Second, the commercialization of Alaska North Slope gas resources through the sale of LNG to global markets and access for in-state demand. Third, creating jobs for Alaskans in the exploration, development, production, and transportation of natural gas. Fourth, increasing opportunities for the Alaska-based businesses, for Alaska-based businesses. Fifth, providing additional revenues to the state of Alaska, and finally, building infrastructure for the development of onshore and offshore oil and gas exploration and production. If those sound familiar, yeah, those are from the heads of agreement, and I believe that they're very good goals for us to follow as board members. With that, I'd briefly like to discuss my background and how I believe I'd be qualified to be an effective board member for AGDC. I have served a career in business and finance, most recently as the chairman and CEO for the PT Capital family of companies. PT Capital is in the midst of building a private equity firm that focuses on investments in small to mid-market companies in Alaska, Canada, Iceland, and Greenland. Our company is the first for Alaska, as traditional private equity investment in Alaska has been through PE firms from outside the state. I've built this company anchored by one of the largest sovereign wealth funds globally, with one of the most pristine reputations for investment, and surrounded by other well-regarded investors. Additionally, our subsidiary PT Securities is the most northern FINRA-regulated Securities and Exchange Commission registered broker-dealer investment bank in North America. PT Securities works with small to mid-market companies that have needs to raise capital and debt for the growth and development of their business. Both of these services are first-to-market companies that have been created to help spur the further development of a strong financial services sector in the state of Alaska. Moving on to my two-year tenure as the chairman, just over 2 years as the chairman of the board of the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority, more than $530 million in capital and associated contributions by partners were appropriated. In addition, the board approved due diligence on another $295 million in infrastructure development projects, including the first investments in oil drill rigs. As chairman of the board of the Alaska Energy Authority, concurrent to my chairmanship at ADA, I was responsible for the implementation of the Susitna-Wautana hydroelectric project. As you know, the project could generate 50% of the current rail belt electric demand, or 2.8 million megawatt hours of annual energy. As proposed, Susitna-Wautana will include the construction of a dam, reservoir, and related facilities in a remote part of the Susitna River. Transmission lines connecting into the existing rail belt transmission system and an access road will also be constructed. The Alaska Energy Authority is in the early stages of a long, complex permitting process with FERC, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, which I led as chairman. The anticipated cost of this project is $5.19 billion, including licensing and construction. When I took over as chair for both AEA and ADA, performance evaluations had not been completed in a few years for both of our executive directors. I found this unacceptable and immediately began to work with staff to implement these important management tools. We tied key performance metrics to overall organizational goals of both AEA and ADA, and focusing the work of the board on large strategic items that drove results. As president and CEO of Alaska Growth Capital, Alaska's only business and industry development corporation, of which I left in 2013, I was responsible for the deployment of over $240 million worth of capital and financing for the acquisition and construction of telecommunications network for GCI, utilizing creative finance tools to ensure the best possible cost of capital to support the high-cost Arctic rural build-out. In remote communication, the remote communication towers create state-of-the-art communication networks, improving healthcare, economic opportunities, and improving the life safety of many in rural Alaska. In addition to this, I was responsible for the financing and capital needs of businesses that worked in Alaska's oil, mining, tourism, retail, logistics, and transportation industries. These companies form the support foundation of the core natural resource exploration and production that drives our economy in Alaska. In a state that is so dependent on access to lands and resources, the financial support of Alaska Growth Capital was and continues to be vital to the business operations of many companies that otherwise would not be able to access capital. On a personal note, my Inupiaq mother, Mildred Short, was born in the isolated community of Moses Point in 1942, just outside of Elam. My father, Hugh Short Sr., who turns 90 this year, immigrated to Alaska in 1956 from northern British Columbia. I was born in the western town of Bethel and had the honor of serving as mayor of the community for 2 years. I live in Girdwood now with my wife of almost 20 years and our three daughters. As a board member for the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation, I would work to ensure that the business of the AGDC was squarely on the focus of commercializing Alaska's gas, not politics. I have a track record of focusing on ensuring that the state does not make bad business decisions and creates opportunity and jobs for those that live here. I would use this to serve the board and contribute to the important task at hand with the governor, the legislature, and to make Alaska's gas competitively globally and locally and build the important infrastructure necessary to make this happen. Thank you for your time. Be happy to take any questions and appreciate the opportunity to sit in front of the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Short. I want to take a moment. I'm reading from the statutes of the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation. This is AS3125020, governing body. Public members of the board shall be appointed by the governor and are subject to confirmation by the legislature. When appointing a public member to the board, the governor shall consider the individual's expertise and experience in natural gas pipeline construction, operation and marketing, finance, large project management, and other expertise and experience that is relevant for the purpose, powers, and duties of the corporation. So I read that just to give committee members a brief explanation of the duties. So questions for Mr. Short. Yes, Senator Coghill.
Thank you, Hugh Short, for stepping up, take the appointment. You've had quite an interesting career, and you've looked at this AGDC percolating along. Now you've had a chance at this point, I think, to go through one meeting, if I remember correctly. Any first impressions that that you see coming from other project issues into this one?
Through the chair, Senator Coghill, I believe that we have tailwinds and we have headwinds in this project. Let me discuss the tailwinds. The commercialization of Alaska's natural gas in 2020, 2022, 2024, from a geological perspective and a production perspective of the fields, is very timely. If you look at the amount of pressure reduction from the wells, it's gone from about 4,400 PSI down to about 3,300. If you look at the amount of gas, of liquids that we put through the pipeline, that's gone from a high in 1996, 1997 of about 95,000 barrels equivalent down to about 30,000 barrels equivalent. And so what we're seeing is a very quick depletion of the effectiveness of re-injecting gas. In addition to that, the effectiveness of injecting water into the wells. And I think that what has driven the oil companies, the majors, our partners, and us together, along with TransCanada, is the realization that from a, not only from a alignment perspective, it makes a lot of sense for us to sell our gas on the market now. For Prudhoe Bay, Kuparuk, and Point Thompson, those three fields in many ways are at their life cycle where our gas actually makes sense to get to market. So let me just say that. I think that I hate to use the word, but I think that there's a sort of alignment of the stars. Been said in this building before, hasn't happened. But I think that from a geological perspective, there's an alignment there. I think the headwinds, I was just traveling last week in Asia, and I had lunch with a very, very reputable shipbuilder. They currently have 35 ships under contract, LNG transport vessels. 15 of those are going to the Arctic. Not our Arctic, they're going to Yamal. And they're going to ice break. These are ice breaking LNG transport vessels. At 70 degrees, they're projected to transport 15 vessels to Europe and then to Asia when it's not winter, when it's ice-free. In addition to that, they're constructing perhaps 12 or 15 vessels for Mozambique, which is coming online with perhaps 10 million tons of gas, LNG. Significant amount of gas hitting the market. And finally, gas has gone from 12 months ago where it was on the spot market in Asia, $13 an MCF, down to $7 an MCF today. And so from a headwinds perspective, we are not in a commodity-friendly market today to have the conversations around sort of long-term production. The good news is we're in pre-feed. We go to feed. I think I had a conversation just today, and I think the option to look based on the amount of resources, the option, the likelihood that we as a state, that the majors, our partners, look at it and say the ability to get through feed and to FID makes a lot of sense perhaps from a risk-reward perspective. I think that we may find that in a year. I'm hopeful. But today, in today's market, I think that we're certainly in a situation where the commodity price of LNG globally is not friendly to the timing of our project yet. I hope I answered your question.
That's
follow-up?
No, I think that's a good start to the discussion because first impressions, and especially trying to get gas to market. So at this point, one of the questions, this is now stepping back to the headline questions. Those of us who read the headlines, they see Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation and this alignment that we've been able to build between the producers and the state and TransCanada on the AKLNG, which they're both looking at that very information you just talked about. The question is, do we just move ahead in a competitive way with the AKLNG from your board's perspective? It'd be just a question that just falls out because of the headlines we've seen. Have you developed a perspective on that?
Through Madam Chair, Senator Coghill, I can only speak from my perspective, and I can only speak from one meeting. This represents about 1% of the reading material that I need to get completely up to speed to be an effective board member. But what I do know is that Governor Walker and I have had initial vetting conversations about my background, how I could help in this process. I think that Governor Walker has been very public, and I don't think I need to go into the details into sort of his public statements. I will tell you that I was appointed to ADA and AEA by Governor Parnell, and I will tell you that it's public record that I was not a financial supporter of Governor Parnell, nor a financial supporter of Governor Walker through fundraising, through the campaign process. I have managed to try and maintain a business perspective when dealing with the state's assets, whether it's AEA, ADA, and if I do get the honor and the pleasure of serving on this board, it will be with a business perspective. And my goal is to, as a board member, we approved a resolution as well as a motion at our first board meeting. The transcripts or the records of that meeting will clearly show that I asked some very tough questions of our management. I asked our legal counsel, our general counsel, whether we were, with the resolutions or the motion, violating any contracts or any laws or anything that had been negotiated previously. Answer clearly was no. I voted in favor of the resolution, which allows our executive staff to come up with a rough estimate of what the cost would be to go from a 600 ASMI, AMSI.
ASME,
thank you. Phone a friend. To 900. I think that that's a prudent thing to do. I think that there's associated cost and compression and gas treatment that will also be looked at, and I look forward to the meeting in early April to get some preliminary results back. I will tell you that anything I do as a board member for AGDC will not put in jeopardy AKLNG, because as I said, I think we've got tailwinds behind us. I think we've got more alignment of incentives between us and the partners than we've ever had. And I think that there is a high likelihood that we will be able to have a shot if we can all work together I'm going to call us an investment group. If the state of Alaska can work together to bring this to market. So I think that to answer your question, I think that we've got a good opportunity. I voted for the resolution, and my goal is to look at this from a very serious perspective, from the business economics, the macroeconomic global perspective as to what our LNG is worth in the market, and then try and help us get that to market.
Madam Chair,
yes.
I want to do a follow-up, but I can tell you, Mr. Short, we're dependent upon you to do that. And that's one of the requirements in the statute. But we're going to lean heavy on you for that business perspective. So thank you.
Further questions? Senator Michicki.
I have a question. Welcome, Mr. Short. I like what you said about your focus on monetizing Alaska gas instead of politics. I think it's key in this entire process. But when you talked about the $8 commodity price, actually I think you said $7 commodity price, some of us have been watching that price for a while now, and things fluctuate wildly. But I guess my analysis is that any decision on a natural gas pipeline 20 years ago would have been the right decision today, right? And the analogy I often use is that the difference between a good haircut and a bad haircut is about 5 days. Time healed some of those wounds. But how do you reconcile today's commodity price with the time value of money and the long-term commodity value of Alaska's LNG?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, great question. And I think it's a question that that Exxon, that BP, that ConocoPhillips, and that us as a partner need to approach very seriously. I think that it's highly likely when we get to a FEED decision in 2016, the economic environment for the price of LNG will be very similar to today. I don't expect significant differences in that. I think the real, I think when you analyze going from pre-FEED to FEED and then ultimately the big checks to write in FID, I think what you need to look at is three factors. One, who's the market? What is that market and what's their appetite for your fuel? We'll be coming, I asked a question in our meeting, we'll be coming to market with one of the world's largest liquefaction plants, period. This plant will be three times bigger than the average liquefaction facility in the world, 20 million tons of LNG. So with that amount of resource, you have the ability to create markets. You have an economies of scale that ultimately allow you to potentially attract customers, steal customers, move customers away. I think the market is an important factor. And I really lean on Exxon, BP, and ConocoPhillips because they have marketing teams that are brilliant in assessing what the market is, where the market could go. I think the second factor is going to be on how we can get the cost of this project to a number that makes sense. When you look, you know, I think we have a very competitive field. I think the location that we've chosen in Nikiski is very competitive. What's not competitive for our project right now, or the question mark, is the 800-mile pipeline. And so I think what we need to do is be able to come to the point where we feel very comfortable with the capital cost and any cost overruns and being comfortable with the overall project management. And then I think the third point is going back to your haircut analogy, I think this is going to take a significant amount of work on our behalf as well as our partners to be able to pull the trigger on this. I think it has to be a bet on Alaska, on the fact that there's 35 trillion cubic feet of known reserves, but I've seen numbers of 175 trillion cubic feet just in the North Slope proper. If you go over to the Chukchi, I've seen numbers, should that ever get developed, potential another 150 trillion cubic feet. And I think that has to be, you really have to look at a long-term view of this and understand how that works. So my best answer to you is I think we're going to have a much better cost estimate in a short order of time, 6 months, 9 months. We'll have a better cost estimate. I think we're going to get to pre-feed, and it's going to be, next session is going to be very active in these issues. And my best answer to you is, give me a little bit of time to get up to speed. I think that it's going to be a very, very tenuous process to ultimately get to a green light on the construction of this gas line. But it's possible.
So, committee members, it is now 5:02 p.m. We typically adjourn at 5 p.m. If we have options here. We can hold Mr. Short over, interview him telephonically even in another hearing. We could conclude now and sign a confirmation document. What would be your pleasure, Senator Stedman?
Sign the confirmation document, send him on his way.
So I will ask other committee members, do you wish to hold him over? Let me ask you that. Anyone wish to hold him over?
I don't wish to hold him over. I wouldn't mind just... Is anyone okay with a couple more minutes, Madam Chair?
We could also, that is a third option. I do have someone online who wishes to testify. Would you be willing to wait a few more minutes, committee?
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Sir.
Probably in a couple minutes I have to leave. I have one of the subcommittees.
That I also have another subcommittee. So I think there are other commitments here. 5-10 minutes?
Yep.
Yes. Senator Machiki, you had another question. Is that true?
I did.
Okay.
So I guess what I, yes or no,
on commodity price versus a competitive cost per unit and reserve reliability, less focus on commodity price, more focus on the other benefits to Alaska. Is that a yes or no?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, tough yes or no question. I think that what I'm afraid of when you look at ASAP, and I'm going to answer this question through this way, what I'm afraid of is right now we think that there's 250 MCF appetite. Mm-hmm. I'll share a story. At ADA, I was the chairman when Fairbanks LNG trucking project came on board, the 9 BCF facility that was contemplated on the North Slope. GVEA at the time had said 3 to 4 BCF is what we could take, and then the market will come. And I was very, very uncomfortable building that facility because if you look at the subsidy required in years 1 through 5, it was substantial to the balance sheet of ADA or the state of Alaska. So given the future outlook of state revenues, where we're at, I think it's going to be very difficult to build a gas line without markets that are going to make it sustainable on its own. And I don't think I would like to come back to you as an AGDC board member asking for a subsidy for the first 4 years of operation. So I believe that the commodity price is very important in this project. I think ultimately we are going to be in a situation where we're going to have to make that decision. And I believe that it's going to be difficult to subsidize in-state use and make it affordable for the average consumer.
Follow-up?
So you're missing the pipeline experience, right? We talked about the qualifications for that, and that's okay. That's just, it is what it is. But based on your experience at ADA and AEA and Alaska Growth Capital as well as PT Capital, tell us how those qualifications fulfill the need, the needs that we have for someone that's adequately qualified at AGDC.
I think there's, through the chair, Senator Michicki, I think there's two bits that I wanna put back together, and the first is I'm a believer in Sioux City and Wautauna. I think the fact that we got that going the first 3 years, that it's on its way to FERC, I think it'd be a shame to invest that money and not get a FERC license. I think that's an asset that we can use. So I started a project, and I really hope that that project finishes. On the tail end, Healy Clean Coal was a project that had sat there for 17 years. And at ADA, under my chairmanship and with some very smart people at ADA, we were able to cut a deal with GVEA, which ultimately will get that plant to light this summer. And I think that that is, from my perspective, the investment of $280 million that went into that to see it light this summer and provide 50 megawatts of energy to consumers at 5 cents a kilowatt hour is an amazing feat after 17 years of being stuck. And so I'd like to take those skills along with my track record in investment and the types of projects I've worked on and really apply them to this. And finally, I would say that I owned a Subway in Bethel. It was the first fast food restaurant in Western Alaska. Now, there was no $5 footlong in Bethel. All right, and this was 2001. It was a $11.99 footlong. And that was a very, very expensive restaurant to run. I compared my price of $2,800 a month in electrical expense to my friend Steve Adams in Anchorage, who was paying something like $350 or $400. And trying to say, how can a business make it work? I think the fact that I've ran large corporations in rural Alaska and then have now created a company that operates on a global scale is skills that I think I could bring to the board and hopefully contribute as a board member. Thank you.
Good. We'll open public testimony. I do have one person signed up online. Just evidence, yes. Mr. Landfield, you are in Anchorage. It looks like at the LIO, you're an off-net. Can you hear us?
I can, yes.
Thank you. So if you would identify yourself for the record and your affiliation and give us your testimony, I will ask you to limit that to 2 minutes, please.
Yeah, I'll be quick. My name's Jeff Landfield. I'm in Anchorage. I don't have any affiliation. I just wanted to raise one issue and see if Mr. Short could comment on his position at PT Capital, chairman and CEO, and as far as I know, they're committed to raising funds to do work in infrastructure in the Arctic, and I was wondering if he sees any conflict of interest in that title, and then also having a position on the AGDC board and being exposed to, you know, it could be information that would benefit his company.
Mr. Landfield, we appreciate your public testimony. It is not protocol for public members or public members of the public to call in and inquire of people testifying before a committee. That's the responsibility of the committee. If you have comments you'd like to make about the appointment, we'd be happy to receive them.
Basically, what I just said is my testimony.
Thank you very much. And if you have anything further you'd like to send in writing, you can certainly direct it to my office. But thank you for testifying. Is there anyone else in the room that wishes to testify on this appointment? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. Thank you very much, Mr. Short. We appreciate you being here today.
Thank you.
So in accordance with AS 3905-080, the Resources Committee reviewed the following and recommends the appointments be forwarded to a joint session for consideration. Alaska AGDC Board of Directors, Hugh Short. Attorney General, Department of Law, Craig Richards. This does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of the individuals during further sessions. So I'll pass this document around, have members sign it. And with that, our next meeting will be Wednesday, March 25th. We will take up House Bill 132, and if there is time, Senate Bills 68 and 48. At this time, the meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect. It is 5:10 p.m.